Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, worldwide on HD Radio, and on www.irishradio.com. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilteas deach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, we've had another action-packed week here at 1 Washington Mews. On Thursday night, we had our annual Tom Quinlan Lecture in Poetry. We were delighted to host the winner of the 2014 Seamus Heaney Prize, Tara Bergen. And next week, or over the coming weeks at some point, we will have an opportunity to hear the interview I undertook with Tara while she was here in town with us. She is participating in Poetry Fest 2014 this weekend. So if any of you are interested in finding out more, do go on to the Irish Arts Centre website and find out more about what's going on with Poetry Fest 2014. It is running until the 9th of November. Last night here at Glucksman Ireland House, we were delighted to host Stuart Neville and Lee Child as the new book Belfast Noir was launched. It was a fantastic evening, and I know all of you who were here enjoyed it. And in a later program, we'll hear excerpts from the audio of that evening as well. For the calendar next week, on Thursday, November 13th at 7 p.m, we're delighted to mark the 100th anniversary of the founding of the New York GAA, the Gaelic Athletic Association, with the All-Ireland winning Donny O'Sullivan. Donny's going to come and talk to us about the development and importance of Gaelic games in New York for many Irish immigrants, and he's going to talk about a new documentary which is called Aspects of Identity, an Enduring Tradition. As I said, that's on November 13th, Thursday, November 13th at 7 p.m. Now, I have mentioned since I started hosting this program a project called the Bordeaux Dublin Letters Project, and it is about a collection of letters. They were discovered by a colleague of mine, Professor Tom Trucks. So we're going to start off this week's program by having a chat to Tom. That will take place in a few minutes. A few weeks ago, a new book was launched on Yeats. It's called Yeats and Afterwards. It's edited by Marjorie House and Joseph Valenti. Marjorie and Joseph are two renowned scholars in the field of Irish studies, in literary studies, on Yeats. They write on Joyce and many other of the fantastic examples of the Irish literary contributions. While they were in town for the launch of this new book, which is published by the University of Notre Dame Press, they took time out of their schedules to come in and have a chat with us, and they specifically came in and spoke to my colleague, Professor John Waters. I'd like you to take a listen now to their reflections on Yeats and on specifically on the collection of essays collected together in Yeats and Afterwards, and for them to talk more generally about the field of Irish studies and some of the intersections that are demonstrated by Yeats and some of the other literary giants. It was a great pleasure to have these very impressive scholars here with us here at Glucksman Ireland House. Joe Valente comes to us by way of the University of Buffalo, and Marjorie House comes to us by way of BC, Boston College, and the Department of English there. So after we have our chat with Professor Tom Trucks, I'm going to hand you over to John's interview and recollections and thoughts with Joe Valenti and Marjorie House. I hope you enjoy this. It's my great pleasure to be here today with a friend and colleague of mine, Professor Tom Trucks, who is a member of faculty here at Luxman Ireland House NYU as part of our Irish Studies faculty, and also he is appointed to the History Department here at NYU. Tom, thanks for taking time out of your busy writing and teaching schedule. You're always driving yourself very hard in terms of meeting deadlines, and thanks for taking time out today.
Yes, I'm glad to be here.
Now, Tom, I would like our listeners, I've referred kind of obliquely a few times to a series of events surrounding the Bordeaux-Dublin letters, which occurred now, unbelievably, it's a year since
it's the year, yes.
Exhibit opened and since the great conference took place. But I'd like the listeners to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour to get a sense of what I'm actually talking about when I refer to this project. And if we could go back to the beginning, if it were, to the origins of this exciting discovery, really, you know, what it has opened up in terms of the vista of the Irish diaspora is really impressive and has implications which you might touch on in terms of looking at other groups as well in the Atlantic world in the 18th century in particular. Can you take us back to, I believe, was it January 2011?
Yes, it was. It was, I'm not going to remember the exact day, but it was mid-January 2011. It was a Friday. I remember it exactly the minute this happened. I was at the British National Archives in Kew, which is outside of London. It's a huge repository of archives. In fact, it's one of the world's great collections of archives. And I was there doing research on a book project that is dealing with an entirely different subject. When I happened to stumble onto this collection, and stumble is the exact right word, because the collection I was looking in is massive. It is a collection of approximately 70,000 uncatalogued letters collected by the British Navy over a period of well over 150 years, really from about the middle part of the, in fact, well over 150 years, from the middle part of the 17th century all the way through the end of the Napoleonic Wars, when British warships captured ships belonging to enemy states, ships suspected of dealing with enemy states, the British Navy or privateers in the service of the British Navy removed the documents from the ships, and they were collected for use in the prosecutions that would follow the captures of these ships. The persons on the ships weren't being prosecuted. The ships were actually being prosecuted, and then they would become the property of the captors. And there was a lot of money to be made doing this. Well, over this long, long period of time, thousands of ships were captured. And the documents were kept in various warehouses controlled by the Navy and controlled by the courts. And, for example, in the early stage, they were in the late 18th century, the early 19th century, they were kept in the Tower of London. Later, they were kept just in warehouses in London. And this is a massive collection of letters, as I mentioned, but also court papers. It's huge. And I've been working in this collection for years. It's uncatalogued. And so when you work in it, you're essentially on a fishing trip. You don't know what you're going to find. And you open up a box or a folder, and it may be nothing, or it may be, as in the case of this find, it was a bundle of letters tied in a ribbon, just tucked away, that were written, most of them written by members of the Irish community in Bordeaux, France, in 1757, written to family, friends, and business associates back in Ireland. And the letters were taken off a captured Irish wine ship returning from Bordeaux to Dublin. And the reason that ship was able to make that trip was that it had a license from the British government to carry the wine, and it had a license from the French government to carry the wine, because even in wartime, certain trades continued because they were so profitable and high vested interests had a stake in them. This was one of those trades during wartime. In tobacco, for example, American tobacco, the trade never stopped in tobacco to France in the 18th century during the British-French Wars. These things continued, as in modern times, trade sometimes continues between belligerents. So in any case, this was the mailbag from a ship called the Two Sisters of Dublin on its way back home with just the mail of ordinary people. And it was, these packet contained 125 letters. So that's 125 of the 70,000 letters that are in the collection. And it's one of the great untapped historical resources, and we're very fortunate to have found this set of letters. There's other Irish material there, too. In fact, it's one of the most fertile places for historians to work, and it's very exciting. Most of these letters, 85 of the 125, were unopened when I found them. And I had the experience, which was a thrilling experience, of opening the mail. When I alerted the staff at the Record Office, the National Archives is called the Record Office among people who work there. When I alerted them, they took the letters away and they set up a workstation for me. So the following week, I spent 2 full days opening the letters. They had cut the seals with a razor blade and I opened the letters. And it was really a thrilling thing because back at that time, they would put a pinch of sand in the letters to dry the ink. And you may have seen that in movies. But sure enough, when I opened the letters, the sand would come out of the letters. They had never been opened. And these are some of them very intimate, personal letters, too.
So, Tom, I want to remain on that point for a minute because you've been in this business a while.
Yes. I've got dirt under my fingernails.
You've got dirt under your fingernails. But to go into a repository and have this opportunity of opening literally mail,
yes,
that the seals, as you, and just for the benefit of our listeners, they are what you imagine in terms of those
gorgeous,
wax,
yes,
seals,
yes,
and they've been,
yes,
opened with a razor for you, but you're
just for me, yes,
you're opening these,
yes,
for the very first time. I mean, is it one of the all-time high points of your academic career?
Sure it is, yes. There was an especial resonance in this case, partly from the experience of opening the letters and discovering them, but partly because my mentor at the time of my doctoral studies in Ireland at Trinity College in Dublin, Louis Cullen, is the authority on the Bordeaux community and has written 2 books on them. His books weren't on the community. His books were on what the community was doing. They were on the cognac and brandy business in France, which had a very strong Irish element. So Louis has researched and studied this extensively. And so to find this material that was what my mentor had worked on from the time he was a young man and was still interested in was a real thrill. And so that's why I instantly saw it. When I saw the letters in just a flash, I knew what they were because I knew Louis's work. And instantly I knew I could connect them with the Bordeaux community and with wartime trade. And then to open them and to realize that these were very private, intimate letters that were never going to be delivered to the person.
So you're the
directed.
You're the ultimate voyeur in 2011.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
So,
yes.
You know, Tom, it's such a rich collection. You've so beautifully and concisely described the collection of what this 70,000 encompasses. And then you're looking at this little sliver and insight into the Irish community in Bordeaux in 1757. Of the 125 letters in this collection, what jumps out at you as being the most common themes or what resonated with you the most?
I think the striking thing, and readers of the published letters, I think we'll see this immediately, is the emphasis on family, the concerns that we would have. There isn't anything about these letters that seems foreign. What is so wonderful about them is how familiar they are and how much they connect us with the past, and they take away a false impression of the past that people were somehow fundamentally different in some way. And they show us that they're no different. The same kinds of concerns, the same kinds of emotions, and the letters are filled with emotion, are present in this material that we would find in emails. And in fact, we don't necessarily find it in emails so much because there's something about emails that is sort of quasi-public in a way, because we know that those can be looked at. But these letters reveal the humanity of a community 250 years in the past that we would recognize. We would recognize these people. We would know them if we saw them. I think that's the greatest thing about it, is the humanity that comes through the ordinary conversations, because they're conversations between ordinary people. They're half of the conversation, because there'll be another letter coming, another letter going.
So there's a universality,
yes,
to them, Tom,
yes,
and I have had the privilege, mainly because you and I share an office here at Luxman Ireland House, to have seen up close and personal what you have done with this in terms of bringing the entire project to fruition and exploring it in different ways through the academic conference, through the book and through the exhibit, which we'll talk about in a moment. But the universality of the themes that you touched on there, and there's one letter where essentially a wife is giving instructions, if I remember correctly, to her husband as to what to bring back from Bordeaux, right?
That's a one of my favorite letters. And I believe two other letters are the only letters in the collection that were written in Ireland and directed to Bordeaux. And that's because they were, the small number of letters were addressed to the captain of the ship, John Dennis. So he had them in his possession, and so when the mail was taken up by the British officers, the naval officers, when they scooped up everything, they scooped up these letters too. These letters were written, this one from his mother to him, and I'll just make a quick word about this one, because as many of our listeners will recognize this conversation, it's the mother giving very strong advice to the son on who he should marry, without insisting that she's not telling him who, but she makes it pretty clear who it's going to be and who it's not going to be. And it's a very entertaining letter. It could be staged, actually, from the mother. But the most touching letter to me, I think the most intimate, I think, of the whole collection, is this very, very simple letter written by John Dennis's wife, Mary Dennis, to him. And she is anxious for his welfare at sea and praying for his safe return. And she tells him that that's all she can think of is a safe return. And it's a very touching, intimate letter. And then she goes on to say, while you're over in Bordeaux, bring some olives back. And don't forget the prunes. And don't forget some other things. And she gives him a little shopping list, because she runs a shop in Dublin. A little shop, and she is making sure that he brings home the milk and the eggs and the bread, just like a wife would tell her husband today. There's something intimately private and touching about the simplicity of that. Mm-hmm. And there is the wife 250 years ago telling her husband, don't forget the eggs and the milk on your way home.
So some things never change.
They don't change. And also, what comes across in these letters is the voice of women, which there's been this something of an ongoing conversation among historians as to, you know, were women literate? Were they not literate? How large a role did they play? How small a role did they play? Well, these letters reveal that women were completely engaged in the life of their families and communities in ways that listeners will find identifiable. There isn't much that has changed with the sun going around 250 times.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess the term that people who work in the social sciences use, the agency of women, is powerful and striking in them. You know, they aren't these passive participants in what's going on. They're decision makers. Right. They're calling the shots on some level, right, in a way that adds nuance to how we see women's role in the past.
And what makes this tiny and, some might say, inconsequential collection important is the fact that it is not a collection of the voices of important, dominant people. It's just a slice of ordinary life. This is not a collection of letters that's been pre-selected, or it represents a pretty wide spectrum of humanity. There were 5 Irish ships in Bordeaux when the two sisters left, and they're all loading wine. They all had passports. And of the 5, the two sisters was the only one captured. It was later released because of the passports. They all had mail bags. Every ship returning had a mail bag. So this is just a completely random sample. So what this random sample tells us, I think we can pay attention to, because it is a random sample. And as I said, one of the striking things is women, and also the range of voices, more than just women, but different social levels and different social standings.
That's a nice segue, Tom, because the other one of the letters that jumps out at me, and again, I'm using the example of a woman, but that's okay, because you guys get to write all the history a lot of the time. And during the conference around the topic of the Bordeaux-Dublin letters, which was really, really fantastic conference here at Luxman Ireland House last fall, and convened by Tom so eloquently and so excellently done. But one of the letters that resonated a lot with people attending the conference and led to a very interesting intervention was by a scholar from Galway who looked at the letter from the servant girl. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. This is a letter from a young woman, Mary Quinn, who is probably, she could be a teenager, she could be in her late teens, she could be as old as 20, I think, but she's a young woman. It's clear she's a young woman. It's a long, long letter. It's one of the longest. In fact, it may be the longest in the entire set. And it's written by a serving girl who is in the employ of one of the wealthy Irish wine merchants in Bordeaux. And she's writing to her sister, Catherine Norris, in Dublin. And it's almost, I shouldn't say almost a work of literature, it is a work of literature. It's written in a stream of consciousness voice. It's very undisciplined that way. It's very unaffected. There's no affectation at all. One of the striking things about correspondence, and when you spend a lot of time with it, is you realize that as one moves up the social scale, the correspondence has increasing levels of affectation or formality about them and is less insightful. So this letter has none of that. And she's talking about her life in the house and her relationships and the comings and goings of the house and her dreams and her visions and her, and it's in the stream of consciousness format, which is really astonishing. Well, at the conference, Marie-Louise Coulihan, who is an English scholar at the University of Galway, National University of Ireland at Galway, presented a paper in which she showed, and this is really brilliant, she showed that the characterization of the serving girl in a famous English novel written in the 1740s called Pamela, some of our listeners will know this book, by Joseph Richardson. Marie-Louise Coulihan showed that this man's depiction of the inner life of a serving girl in the 1740s was spot on. And the book has been criticized, Richardson's book, of the 18th century, written in the 18th century, has been criticized for being a false portrayal of the life of women or of the woman's voice, because he was a man, after all. And how could a man know the workings of the mind of a serving girl in a big house? Well, Marie-Louise Coulihan drew wonderful parallels between the letter from Mary Quinn and the letter from Pamela. It was a wonderful thing to see, which we really encourage as much as possible, scholars reaching across the borders of the disciplines, mm-hmm. and historians speaking to literary scholars and learning from them and vice versa. And this was a really good example of it. Marie-Louise Coulihan is on her way to becoming one of the real stars of early modern Irish literary studies, because her emphasis is on the voice of women and the writings and interpretations of women. It's really good work.
Very sensitively done, yes, and with a grounding in the history, which is so important. Now, Tom, for the benefit of our listeners, and that letter that you described by Mary Quinn is in English, how many of them, again, were in French?
Well, of the 125, by some alchemy which is beyond my understanding, exactly 25 were in French and 100, exactly 100 were in English. And some of the letters in French were written by French people to family and friends living in Ireland. So it was kind of the reverse of this. So the preponderance of the letters come from members of the Irish colony in France back home, but then some also come from French people to essentially what was a French colony in Ireland, mm-hmm. and gives us a sense of the mobility of that time, the international character of the world. And some of those letters are quite good. And my colleague here at NYU in the history department, John Shovlin, who happens to be Irish by coincidence, really, was a colleague, a co-editor of the book, managing the material in French, because John's research specialty and his scholarly reputation is all associated with mid-18th century French social and economic history. So he was just perfect for this. And the French material, so there's 25 letters in French, as I said, but some of those are also, I should point out, written by Irish people writing in French back home. There's one Irish man, John Black, who writes to some of his children, and he writes to his children in English, and he writes to a colleague back in Ireland in French. So it shows us the sophistication of members of this community.
This find, Tom, culminated in the conference we've just mentioned a couple of times, which attracted leading scholars in the Atlantic world in French history, and was a real wonderfully stimulating few days of reflection on what had come out of this collection and the implications for the world more generally that this collection of letters reflects on. It also culminated in a stunning exhibit which ran at NYU's Bopes Library until April of this year, April 2014. You did reproductions of the letters and set it in the context of what was going on basically in the Irish diaspora in the 18th century. Can you tell us a little bit about the exhibit?
Yes. Maybe some of our listeners saw the exhibit, and I hope they did have a chance to see it. The exhibition was partly about the letters, but it was really more about the world of the letters. The letters were central to it, physically central to it, actually, but it was about the world. And it was about the world of the Irish abroad at that moment in time. And that moment in time was the opening months of the year 1757, which is a time in which the world was at war. There was a high degree of uncertainty as to the direction of that war. At that time, the British were losing. They eventually won. Communities cut off by war, families separated, and Irish communities in all the major Western European states and in North America and in the West Indies. And so what we did with the exhibition was we broke it into three parts. One part creating the world at war and the story of the ship. The ship, there's a dramatic story of the ship and its capture and its release. That was the world at war. And in that part of the story, we talked about what Dublin was like in this point in time, what Bordeaux was like, what the war was all about, those sorts of issues. That was in a set of exhibition cabinets, if you can picture the space, a big, large room. So if you're entering it, that would be to your far left. And the middle section, the exhibition cabinets featured letters organized according to themes. And we had a sample of 20 of the 125 letters and sorted up by themes. And for example, a theme might be something like the voice of men, the voice of women, siblings. It could be the world of business. It could be students, the life of students abroad. So there were 20 of those themes. There were 10 themes and two representative letters in each of those. And then we, if you can picture this now, on the far right exhibition cabinets, we then depicted the world of the Irish abroad, and we broke it into two parts. One depicting Irish communities in Europe at that time, and that would have been centered on the London community, which was thriving at that time, and very important in Irish economic and social life, large Irish community in London, the Irish community in Iberia, Spain and Portugal, the Irish community in France, and the Irish community in the Low Countries. And then on the American side, we showed the Irish in the West Indies. We showed them in the middle colonies, which is essentially in North America, that would be New York and Pennsylvania, because at that time, that was where the concentration of Irish people were. And then we showed the Irish in Newfoundland, which was the largest Irish community in the Americas. So we showed them in the West Indies, we showed them in the Middle Colonies, we showed them in Newfoundland, and we showed them on the American frontier, where they were numerous. And we set the stage as much as we could by emphasizing the situation these communities were in and why they were there and how they fit into the social world. And we gave some examples of important leaders. For example, in Spain, we showed Ricardo Wall, who listeners may not know who Ricardo Wall is, but he was the Prime Minister of Spain at the time the ship Two Sisters was captured. He was an Irishman born not far from Limerick. And in the Americas, we depicted Sir William Johnson, who was also born in Ireland. And he and Benjamin Franklin were the two most famous Americans in the world at the time the ship was captured. So what we're showing was a very different Irish world from what listeners may imagine. This was a world in which the Irish people played a very prominent place in the world and were making the world happen. And it is entirely consistent with the Irish role in the world that they would be leading players in the French wine business. And listeners can go to any local wine shop and see some of those Irish names on the wine bottles. It takes a little careful looking, but you'll find them and try the wine. That's so awfully good.
So, Tom,
the best of the best.
Hopefully we will, and I look forward to at some point in the not-too-distant future, telling listeners about when that exhibit will go up again, because it's stunningly beautiful in terms of the array of artwork and imagery that you coordinated from far-flung places. I think probably the furthest was Japan, right? Yes. And you had stuff from Russia.
Big cooperation worldwide. It was just wonderful.
Yeah, there was a lot of goodwill. Anyone who's been involved in curating an exhibit like that knows how much is involved in terms of every image that was displayed in that large exhibit. We had permission. We had, you know, in certain cases, had to pay fees and things like that. So logistically, what Tom pulled together was no mean feat, and I really do hope soon, genuinely.
But I would have to say we had a very supportive team.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to take that as a bit of a compliment there, because I had the pleasure of working with Tom on this, and it was a lot of fun. For those of you interested in this subject matter, and it really is a fascinating snapshot, as I mentioned in the introduction to this interview, into part of the Irish diaspora that we don't, you know, I really feel like, Tom, this collection of letters sheds light in a way that really will resonate with people in a way that few other collections or sources can. It's available, the Bordeaux Dublin Letters 1757, edited by L.M. Cullen, John Shovlin and Thomas M. Trucks. Tom Trucks, my colleague here. What is the best way for people? It's published by the British Academy and Oxford Press.
I hate to be putting out a plug for Amazon, but that's the easiest way to find it would be just to go to Amazon.
Right.
Or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
It's readily available.
So just search for the Bordeaux Dublin letters, and Tom's last name is spelled T-R-U-X-E-S in case you want to search for it that way. It's a very interesting read and a stunning. The way you've pulled it together, Tom, in the confines of the book is really a tribute to a really great project and so well executed. I hope that at some point soon we can nab you to come in and have a chat to us about some of the other finds that are not totally unrelated to what we've spoken about today. But for now, thank you so much, Tom, and continue with the great work that you keep doing.
Yes, well, thank you very much.
Welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'm Professor John Waters, Director of Studies in the Irish Studies Program. I'm delighted to have with me here at Ireland House today Professor Marjorie House from Boston College and Professor Joe Valente from the State University of New York at Buffalo. Joe and Marjorie are in New York to celebrate the launch of their book Yeats and Afterwards, which is published by the University of Notre Dame Press, and I'm delighted that it brings them here to talk with us today about the work that they've just brought to fruition and the work that they've done in the past. Let me begin by asking about the origins of this volume, Yeats and Afterwards. We're coming up on the sesquicentennial of Yeats's birth, and I know there's always public interest in W.B. Yeats as a poet and as a public figure, but perhaps I could begin by asking, what is it that you think is new about this book, and what led you to propose to collect these voices and to title it Yeats and Afterwards?
Well, we think what is new about it is that we have identified an underlying logic to really all of Yeats's work, all of his career. We called it the logic of the afterword, and it applies not just to individual poems or works or volumes, but it's something that really spans and ties together really everything that he's done, and even his relationship with other writers.
And this underlying logic is a logic of temporality. And as a result, it allows the contributors to sort of go beyond the kind of traditional opposition of formal study versus historical study. And it becomes a kind of method, this afterword becomes a kind of method, a literary device whereby Yeats brings history and his historical engagements into his poetry, right? Not just as a propositional matter, not just as a matter of statement or claim, but into the contours of the work itself, the way the poetry operates.
And I think the origins of it specifically actually lie in a visit I made to Champaign-Urbana, which was early on in when we sort of knew each other, and I watched, we talked about Yeats, and I watched Joe teach Yeats, and at that point he didn't, well, you tell the story.
Well, I was the director of Irish Studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. This was a post that really allowed me to do nothing other than bring people I liked to campus to speak. I had no further funds. I brought Marjorie, and Marjorie stayed a couple of days, and one of the days he stayed, I was teaching a course on Yeats, it was just on Yeats at the time, and Marjorie came and we discussed a couple of the middle poems in Yeats in the class and with Marjorie. And at that point, I had not written anything on Yeats at all, and Marjorie said, you know, you really should write on Yeats. And so I had that in mind, and at a certain point, I thought it might be nice to do a collection. So I asked Marjorie, would you like to do a collection? There was going to be a meeting of the Modernist Studies Association in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we sort of got together at that meeting and sort of plotted out what this collection might look like. And I don't think we had a kind of conceptual model at that point, but I don't think we really had the logic of temporality that ultimately came to play itself out. I mean, that came through an ongoing process of reading people's essays, writing our own individual essays, and then thinking about how the whole operated.
Yeah, it really became clear looking at the whole body of work that had been produced by all the contributors and saying, oh, there's a pattern here. It's flexible, but there is this kind of overarching.
Even at the thematic level of Yeats's, the topics of Yeats's poems, I'm struck by how the poetry of old age and youth and of youth and old age allowed us to see a career-wide pattern of thinking about temporality and producing futurity in the past of being old and pastness in the future of being young, which I think is a remarkable feature of Yeats's, particularly of Yeats's late work. I wonder, Joe and Marjorie, if you might say something about this production of the future in Yeats's afterwards as a way to think about the Irish revival and about revivalism. I know, Joe, your work has been very much engaged with critiques of revivalism as one form or another. And I know, Marjorie, your work on Yeats and Revolution in your first volume is very centrally concerned with thinking about how participation in the revival was also participation in the creation of a new future, too. So I wonder about how you see this book relating to broader studies of the Irish literary revival.
So, actually, our next project, which we are already talking about, we would like to do another collection of essays, which would be rethinking the Irish revival, and in particular Yeats's role in it. I mean, the one thing that's happening in studies of the revival currently is that people are identifying all kinds of different Irish revivals. Some of them are literary, some of them are less literary. And Joe actually came up with a sort of theoretical paradigm for thinking about the differences among them, which has to do with complexity theory, which I will actually let you explain in a minute if you want. But in terms of the current volume, maybe we'll circle back around to our new idea. I guess what I would say, maybe I could answer that question specifically by mentioning a couple things that I did in my essay, where I think we often tend to think of Yeats's revivalism as through his role as the masterful impresario who founded clubs, who managed public controversies, who loved kind of being a public figure, at least part of him did, and who wanted very much to control what was happening. So the revival as a kind of political project institution. On the other hand, Mike, as I looked at Last Poems and at how he began to think about death and what comes after death, and basically I argued that over the course of the volume, he comes to a place where he has to give up. He has to cede control, and he has to kind of submit himself to the forces of contingency instead. And that's not about the revival as a kind of movement generally, but about Yeats in relation to a kind of revivalist project.
Marjorie, if I could ask you to perhaps reflect a little bit about how your career as a scholar of Yeats and of Irish writing has brought you to this point with this project that you've done with Professor Valenti, but how you look back on your volume of essays, Colonial Crossings, as part of the Field Day project, and perhaps your connection with the Field Day anthology project, and then the monograph. And I know there's a lot in there,
okay.
But I'm very curious to always hear scholars talk about their pathway into Irish studies and through Irish studies, and how you might see the work you're doing now in relation to the work you've put out in the past.
Sure. So I actually wasn't trained in Irish studies. I was just trained as a high modernist in an English department. But I wrote a dissertation on Yeats, which got me interested in Ireland, which became a first book, which was called Yeats's Nations. And at the time there was a big set of political debates over Yeats's politics. People attacking him for basically conservative authoritarian politics, people defending him. And what I tried to do in that book was to shift the focus away from those kinds of positive versus negative political stances and say, okay, let's look at the forms that his conceptions of nationality came in, and they changed over the course of his career, and depending on which works we were looking at. So in a way, it was already an interest in form,
It was also already an interest in reproduction, which is part of what Yeats afterwards turned into the question of how Yeats reproduces himself, in what forms does reproduction occur, how does reproduction across Yeats's corpus produce crises and resolutions. I mean, these are issues very much in Yeats and afterwards. And I actually, rereading some of the essays, of course, actually thinking of Yeats's Nation in terms of its discussions of biological reproduction and crisis among the Anglo-Irish and for Yeats particularly, which I think was really actually seminal for the future thinking.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily have seen it then, and I would say the intellectual and academic context in which I was writing felt very different from the kinds of work that is providing a context for a volume like ours.
That's possible now.
Right. Yeah. And then from there, well, some of the research I did for the Yeats book took me back to the 19th century, and that led to some of the chapters in Colonial Crossings. I got interested in some influences on Yeats, and that led to an interest in things like Lady Wilde for her own sake. Then I guess one other development was I became interested in the other 20th century giant, Irish literary giant, and that's Joyce, and I began writing on Joyce some. That was also sparked by some of the things I was seeing in Yeats. And the third development that you mentioned that arose a little bit out of the first book, insofar as it was also interested in kind of feminist and gender studies, like Joe was mentioning, the sort of reproductive issues, is I did get interested in women's writing. And that took me to having a small part in one of the Field Day anthology of Irish writing volumes, one of the last two, which is women's writing and tradition. So in fact, there's these three or four different trajectories branching off of the first Yeats work, which led in really quite different directions, but they all actually did have a sort of common origin, I would say.
What I don't want to not be mentioned in Marjorie's career is the volume Semicolonial Joyce, which
I forgot to mention.
And I think as a contributor to that volume, I like to think of it that it's a really important one. And I do think that, like, one of the things that I thought that was really kind of cool about doing Yeats and afterwards, and the way it turned out, which we're very happy with, is that we've now each both done edited volumes, because I did Queer Joyce, you know, both did edited volumes on both Yeats and Joyce, both of these major figures. I thought there was I did have a kind of a sense of a satisfactory closure around that.
And actually, now that you've brought up Semicolonial Joyce, what we were going for with that volume was to explore a kind of paradigm shift in Irish studies, but in Joyce studies in particular, and that was the rise of post-colonial theory and debates over its relationship to Irish studies and Joyce. So that volume had a very specific purpose, which was let's think about the relationship between this body of theoretical work and Joyce.
Extremely important volume because it took us beyond the concept of applied theory as found elsewhere to say, in fact, the literary and artistic work, and particularly in Joyce, constitutes a body of theory in its own right about the circumstances of Ireland's complex colonial relations and colonial origins.
Right, and
that's actually a great description of the Yeats and afterwards.
But that's actually that idea of the artistic and literary works, body of work constituting a theorization, will take me to my career path. Because actually, my first experience in any kind of an Irish studies setting was in Joyce. And I got into Irish studies through Joyce, and I got into Irish studies through Joyce in relationship to post-structural theory. And my first panel I was on was called Joyce After Deconstruction, and the first thing that was said was the Derrida quote that there is no Joyce after deconstruction because Joyce was already there, right? And it's Joyce that Derrida learned deconstruction, he was reading Joyce. Right? So my career path basically is just a little different. I started out as a romanticist in graduate school. So Yeats is a kind of a little bit of a return in that sense, because as we talked about earlier, I do think Yeats's edition of Blake was an incredibly important moment in Yeats's intellectual development. But then I shifted into Joyce because I had an idea for a dissertation on Joyce, and it was just, so I said, okay, well, I'll do that.
This is Joyce, the Problem of Justice.
This is Joyce, the Problem of Justice. And like Marjorie, I mean, the thing that that really drove what followed was having to go backward to find the conditions of the production of the text that I was looking at, which took me back into the 1890s, which is why I did a book on Stoker, and then back to Parnell in the 1880s, and the Myth of Manliness. So I became...
You'll be a Swift scholar before long, Joe.
Right.
I moved from being a modernist, yes, and sort of moved back, but also I got really interested doing Queer Joyce. I got really interested in questions of dissident sexuality, which has brought me now, other work I do is like on Jamie O'Neill and on contemporary, on later and in contemporary Irish literature around questions of sexuality. The Myth of Manliness sort of contains it all.
Yeah, so if I could ask you just to say just a few words about the Myth of Manliness in Irish National Culture.
Okay, well,
University of Illinois Press, 2011.
And yeah, you all were nice enough to throw me a seminar when the book came out. That was great. And the Myth of Manliness is the book that actually I really started writing about Yeats in, because the epilogue is on Yeats and addresses particular Yeats poems to Ashane. And also there's a section on sovereignty drama and sovereignty parody, and Yeats figures heavily in that. And that's a book which really does bring together both the backward movement, because it required a grounding in the 19th century. It brings together my interest in gender, which the Joyce and the Problem of Justice was really about gender justice more than anything else, and sexuality. And I was interested in what I took to be, still take to be, at the time was certainly kind of under-theorized idea of masculinity in Ireland, that there had been such, a tremendous amount of work done on women in Ireland, on femininity in Ireland, on the feminization of Ireland, et cetera, et cetera. I was really interested in the way in which the Irish, in the period following the construction of manliness as the dominant trope of masculinity in the 19th century, responded to this, particularly since so many of the people who were responsible for articulating manliness were also responsible for kind of quasi-ethnological representations of the Irish, which were hardly flattering.
Very important. All of the work that you are both pursuing and that you brought into this volume, Yeats and afterwards, seems to my way of thinking to be very timely in thinking through a broader problem in literary studies, which is, how do we understand the pendulum swings between post-structuralism and historicism and a return to poetics or aesthetic theory? And how do we square the circle between the dynamic shifts toward a kind of profound engagement with historical thinking and historicist criticism, and also a recognition that literature is a particular kind of discourse that has its own properties and its own rules, and that thinking about poetics and poesis is a crucial part of what literature can do. So I'm persuaded by you that Yeats and Afterwards is a terrific volume for seeing that dialogue sort of taking place, but it's also something I see taking place in reflections on Seamus Heaney, for example, and the period since Heaney's death, about how Heaney's relation to poetics and thinking about poetic form has always been in tension with his very specific cultural and territorial circumstance as a Catholic from the north and the like. And so I wonder if you see your work as marking territory in the debate that literary theory has between historicism and poetics as modes of doing literary scholarship, or do you find that you're given a reprieve from thinking that way?
Marjorie?
Well, in a way, we are given a reprieve because I think our conception of what the volume as a whole does is to use poetics and form as a way to approach historical questions and history. So the logic of the afterword is not just a kind of poetic logic, it's also a way of thinking about history.
I would put it this way. We all know, literary scholars, cultural scholars, we all know that there is no binary between literary form or poetics and historical engagement. We all know that at the theoretical level, and then at the operational level, we tend to fall into these camps where we do one or we do the other, right?
And it's very hard to do both.
Right, yeah. Right. And so I think what I hope, and this may be, you know, this may be a fond hope, what I hope what's going on in the essays of Yeats and afterwards is trying to come to an understanding that when we talk about form and when we talk about formal differences and different literary methods, we are talking about different kinds of engagement with history, that's what poetic form is. It's a particular kind of engagement with history, which is why you can't simply reduce it to some kind of allegorical reflex reaction of an historical circumstance or condition, because it's particular, right? And neither, on the other hand, can you remove it in that particularity from the historical, because it's a particular mode of engagement with history, right? So I hope that Yeats and afterwards does that, and I think that the idea of the afterwards, the idea that in the poetic word itself, understood as an afterword, is a logic of time, right? Suggests that those two elements that we tend to divide ourselves into operationally are in the poetry itself undivided and in fact mutually energizing.
Which brings us back to Blake, I think, again. And it's so important to recognize the influence of Blake on Yeats, but also the way that Blake's own relation to his time lays out what modernity might be at one level, which is this, I think, imbrication of form and history in the sense that we're speaking about.
And I gave there was a conference in Los Angeles, UCLA, on aestheticism, and I gave the first version of the essay that I have in the Yeats and Afterwards volume at that conference. And one of the things I found interesting was it was assembled people, all of whom were well sort of invested in it. And one of the things I found interesting was I kept referring to Yeats as a profoundly dialectical thinker, and I kept getting puzzled reactions from people who seemed to think that this was an entirely new idea. And I bring that up just because it can't be a new idea, because Blake was a profoundly dialectical thinker, and Yeats learned so much doing his edition of Blake's poetry. Right? And I do think that the question of dialectic is really a way of thinking through this form.
I'm in complete agreement. I'd say a very interesting place is in Yeats' autobiographies, where he reflects on the wanderings of Rasheen and on the form of the poem, and how he understood that he was trying to do something in the form of the poem to express a view of historical forces as they were operating in allowing the tales of Rasheen to come into the present. And then thinking about the myth, as he says in the note to the poem, the power of the myth of progress at the moment that he wrote the poem was a myth that he was trying to grapple with through a logic of circularity in The Wanderings of Rasheen. I can see right there at age 25, 26, we have a poet who is thinking formally, dialectically.
Right, and it's like three-dimensional chess. Yeah. I mean, you've got to get to that third level beyond the sort of how does the content you know, respond to the history. You've got to get to that third level of how the form can be complete with content, right?
I'm delighted to have welcomed Professor Marjorie Howes and Professor Joe Valenti to Glucksman Ireland House to talk with us about their new volume, Yeats and Afterwards, published by the University of Notre Dame Press. I hope they'll come back again soon and talk with us about the next volume that they're planning. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
We're coming towards the end of the program for another week. Before I finish up, I want to undertake some shameless self-promotion. This is on behalf of the New York Irish Centre. On Tuesday, November 11th, at the New York Irish Centre in Long Island City, that great institution and organisation which is serving the community so well over a few decades now, they've invited me to have a chat to people about the history of the Ford plant in Cork in Ireland. Some of you may or may not know that in 1917, Henry Ford selected Cork for the first Ford factory outside of North America. And this plant was in operation. It actually began operations in 1919, and it was open and a very important employer in Cork City until 1984. This year, 2014, marks the 30th anniversary of the closure of the Ford plant in Cork, which is a massive upheaval for the Cork economy and labour community. So I'm going to have a talk about the research I conducted in the early 2000s on the social history of this Ford plant. And I'll touch a little bit on the Ford family connection with Ireland. Some of you may know that Henry Ford's father, he immigrated to the United States from Ballinascarthy in West Cork in 1847. So Henry Ford had a very close connection with Ireland through the paternal side from the Fords, and also on the maternal side. He was raised in the home of his adopted grandfather, who was a man called Patrick Ahern, who hailed from Cork City as well. So I'm going to have a chat about all those things. That's on Tuesday, next Tuesday, November 11th. The doors will open at 7:30 and the talk will begin at 8 p.m. And if you're so inclined, please come along. We'd love to see you there. We are coming towards the end of the program. Just to remind you, I'm Miriam Nighan, and I want to thank you for listening again to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM, on HD Radio, and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu, and our telephone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for The Adrian Flanelly Show, which is up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Thanks for tuning in. Slán agus beannacht.